Well, good evening and welcome. It's great to see such a nice crowd here tonight. Thank you for joining us here at the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library. For those of you who are guests this evening, you're in the oldest library in the city. We date back to 1754, and we are still around collecting books, making pleasant moments for readers and borrowers and for writers as well. And one way that we do like to do that is to have literary evenings like this evening. Before we introduce our writers this evening, may I ask you to take out your cell phones if you have them, and please turn them off, silence them. If you have pagers, do that as well. For an evening like tonight with the beautiful reading of some short stories, it will be very important. This is the time of year when we ask our library members to support our annual appeal. The money that we raise is critical to supporting literary evenings like this, supporting our library collection, the children's library, readers' services, and the rest of our operating budget. Thank you for helping out this year. We do have copies of both Ms. Lee's and Ms. Bingham's books for sale in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery right outside, and speak to Carolyn Waters. I know that both of the writers would be happy to sign your copies this evening. It's my pleasure now to introduce another friend of the library, Bridget Hughes, who is going to introduce our speakers. Bridget, for those of you who don't know, is the founding editor of a wonderful magazine based in Brooklyn, A Public Space. And Bridget is the 2011 winner of the Penn Nora Meggett Award for a magazine editor whose high literary standards and taste have contributed significantly to the excellence of the publication she edits. So we're very proud to have Bridget the week that she's actually receiving the award tomorrow evening. So please welcome Bridget Hughes.
Thank you to Mark and to the New York Society Library. It's always a delight to come up here for an event in such an elegant space. It gives what we do sort of a different weight than when we're in Brooklyn. I started A Public Space about 5 years ago, and one of the first people I called was Yi Yun Lee to see if she would consider being a contributing editor. I have been reading her work for, I think, about a decade now. And I remember the first day, at the time I was working at the Paris Review, when one of our interns came up from the basement, walking up a spiral staircase with a manuscript in his hand, and he said, "I think you want to read this story right away." I remember the first sentence of the story was, "His story, like the story of every one of us, started long before he was born." That was from Immortality, which was in her first collection, 1,000 Years of Good Prayers. Since then, she has published another collection of stories, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, and the novel The Vagrants. I also want to mention a couple of essays she's written that I think for anyone interested in her work, she's written about her influences. She talks a lot about William Trevor and the importance of his fiction to her work, and she wrote a lovely essay about him in Tin House. And she's also written about, I guess that this would be more of an anti-influence, but about the Chinese writer Eileen Chang for Zoetrope. And in A Public Space last year, she translated the letters of the Chinese writer Shen Songwen, who is known as the Chinese Chekhov. One of the things Yigun and I have talked a lot about over the years at A Public Space and occasionally argued about is the private and public roles of a writer. And one of the reasons we were so delighted to be asked to be part of an event here tonight with Sally Bingham is because she, to my mind, represents a writer who has navigated those two worlds in admirable ways. As some of you may know, she has been a tremendous advocate for feminism and understanding the relationship between art and social change. She founded the Kentucky Foundation for Women and the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History at Duke, where her papers are held, along with the papers of writers like Carson McCullers, Dorothy Allison, and Kathy Acker. Her first novel, After Such Knowledge, appeared in 1960, and she has published quite a number of books since then, short stories, novels, plays, poems, a memoir. Her most recent work, if I'm correct, is a book of poems, If in Darkness, and a collection of stories, Mending, which Saraband Books published earlier this year, and which I think she's going to read from tonight. So with that, thank you again for coming, and I will turn things over to Yiyun Lee.
Good evening. Thank you for having me here. And I'm just very happy to be reading with another short story writer, because I do love stories, and I love the library with, you know, dedicated night to short stories. So I think I'm going to read, it's a long story, I'm just going to read the beginning of a long story called Kindness in my new collection called Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. And I'm going to read from the beginning, so I'm hoping it makes sense, and I'll do a little bit of explanation while I go along. Kindness. I am a 41-year-old woman living by myself in the same one-bedroom apartment where I have always lived, in a derelict building on the outskirts of Beijing. Apart from a trip to a cheap seaside resort taken with my parents the summer I turned 5, I have not traveled much. I spent a year in an army camp in central China, but other than that, I have never lived away from home. In college, after a few failed attempts to convince me of the importance of being a community member, my advisor stopped acknowledging my presence, and the bed assigned to me was taken over by the 5 other girls in the dorm and their trunks. I have not married, and naturally have no children. I have few friends, though as I have never left the neighborhood, I have enough acquaintances, most of them a generation or two older. Being around them is comforting. Never is there a day when I feel that I am alone in aging. I teach mathematics in the middle school. I do not love my job or my students. But I have noticed that even the most meager attention I give to the students is returned by a few of them with respect and gratitude, and sometimes inexplicable infatuation. I pity those children more than I appreciate them, as I can see where they are heading in their lives. It is a terrible thing, you see, even for an indifferent person like me, to see the bleakness lurking in someone else's life. I have no hobby that takes me outside my apartment during my spare time. I do not own a television set. But I have a room for books, at least half a century older than I am. I have never in my life hurt a soul, or if I have done any harm unintentionally, the pain I inflict is the most trivial kind, forgotten the moment it's felt, if indeed it could be felt in any way. But that cannot be a happy life, or much of a life at all, you might say. That may very well be true. Why are you unhappy? To this day, if I close my eyes, I can feel Lieutenant Wei's finger under my chin, lifting my face to a spring night. Tell me, how can we make you happy? The questions put to me 23 years ago have remained unanswerable, though it no longer matters. As you see, Lieutenant Wei died 3 weeks ago at 46, mother of a teenage daughter, wife of a stationery merchant, veteran of Unit 20256, People's Liberation Army, from which she retired at 43, already afflicted with a malignant tumor. She was Major Wei in the funeral announcement. I do not know why the news of her death was mailed to me, except perhaps that the funeral committee thought I was one of her long-lost friends, my name scribbled in an old address book. I wonder if the announcement was sent to the other girls, though now many of them would still at the same addresses. I remember the day Lieutenant Wei's wedding invitation arrived in a distant past, and thinking then that would be the last time I would hear from her. I did not go to the funeral, as I had not gone to her wedding, both of which took place 2 hours by train from Beijing. It is a hassle to travel for a wedding, but more so for a funeral. One has to face strangers' tears and words. One has to repeat words of condolence to irrelevant people. When I was 5, a peddler came to our neighborhood one Sunday with a bamboo basket full of spring chicks. I was trailing behind my father for our weekly shopping of rationed food, and when the peddler put a chick in my palm, its small body soft and warm and shivering constantly, I cried before I could ask my father to buy it for me. We were not a rich family. My father worked as a janitor, and my mother, ill for as long as I could remember, did not work, and I learned early to count coins and small bills with my father before we set out to shop. It must have been a painful thing for those who knew our story to watch my father's distress as two women offered to buy two chicks for me. My father, on the way home, warned me gently that chicks were too young to last more than a day or two. I built a nest for the chicks out of a shoebox and a ripped newspaper and fed them water-softened millet grains, and a day later, when they looked ill, aspirin dissolved in water. 2 days later, they died. The one I named Dot and marked with an ink on his forehead, the first one to go, followed by Mushroom. I stole 2 eggs from the kitchen when my father went to help a neighbor fix a leaking sink. My mother was not often around in those days. I cracked the eggs carefully and washed away the yolks and whites. But no matter how hard I tried, I could not fit the chicks back into the shells. And I can see, to this day, the half shell on Dot's head, covering the ink spot like a funny little hat. I have learned since then that life is like that, each day ending up like a chick, refusing to be returned to the eggshell. So that's the opening of this woman's monologue voice. And I'm going to skip a couple pages, and still she's talking to the reader. A dream has occurred repeatedly over the past 20 years, in which I have to give up my present life and return to the army. Always Lieutenant Weiss in the dream. In the early years, she would smile cruelly at me. Didn't I tell you that you would be back? The question was put to me in various ways, but the coldness remained the same. The dreams had become less wicked as the years have gone by. I am back, I tell Lieutenant Wei. I always knew you would come back, she replies. We are older, having aged in my dreams as we have in real life, the only remnants of previous life among a group of chirpy teenage girls. These dreams upset me. Lieutenant Wei's marriage, 2 years after I had left the army, and her transfer to another city, which would know her only as a married woman and later a mother, and then would see her die, must have wiped her history clean so she could start collecting new memories, not about young, miserable girls in the camp, but about happy people who deserve to be remembered. I never showed up in her dreams, I am certain, as people we keep in our memories rarely have a place for us in theirs. You may say that we too evict people from our hearts while we continue living in theirs. And that may very well be true for some people. But I wonder if I am an anomaly in that respect. I have never forgotten a person who has come into my life, and perhaps it is for that reason I cannot have much of a life myself. The people I carry with me have lived out not only their own rations but mine too, though they are innocent usurpers of my life, and I have only myself to blame. For instance, there's Professor Shen. She was in her early 60s when I met her, but this may be the wrong way to put it, as she had lived in the neighborhood for as long as my father had. She must have watched my generation grow up and studied every one of us before singling me out. I like to imagine it that way, you see. For a lonely woman, It is hard not to make up some scenario that allows her to believe herself special in some minor way. Professor Shen was in her early 60s and I was 12 when she approached me one September evening. I was on my way to the milk station. "Do you have a minute?" she asked. I looked down at the two empty bottles snuggled in the little carrier my father had woven for me. He had painted the dried reed different colors and the basket had an intricate pattern, though by then the colors had all paled. My father had a pair of hands that were good at making things. The wooden pegs he put on the foyer wall for my school satchel and coat had red beaks and black eyes. The cardboard wardrobe had two windows that you could push open from inside. He had built my bed, too, a small wooden one, painted orange, just big enough to fit in the foyer alongside the wardrobe. We lived in a small one-room unit, the room itself serving as my parents' bedroom, the foyer my bedroom. There was a small cube of kitchen and a smaller cube of bathroom next to the foyer. Later it occurred to me that we could not afford much furniture. But when I was young, I thought it was a hobby of my father's to make things with his own hands. Once upon a time, he must have made things for my mother, too. But from the time my memory began, their bedroom had two single beds, my father's bare and neatly made, and my mother's piled with old novels. "Do you have a minute? I am asking you," the old woman said again. I had developed a look of distractedness by then, and she was not the most patient woman. "I was on the way to the milk station," I stammered. "I'll wait for you here," she said, tapping on the face of her wristwatch with a long finger. And I'm going to skip just a couple paragraphs, and she went to the professor's house, the apartment. Professor Shen's place, a one-room unit also, seemed more crowded than ours, even though she lived there by herself. Apart from a table, a chair, and a single bed, the room was filled with trunks. Dark leather ones with intricate patterns on the tops and sides, wooden ones with rusty metal clips, and two matching trunks, once bleached but by then yellow, that more yellow than white, made of bamboo or perhaps straw, I couldn't tell which. On each trunk there were books. She moved a pile of books to make a spot for me to sit on her single bed and then took a seat in the only chair in the room. Up to that point, I had not studied her, but I realized now that she was a beautiful woman, even at her age. Her hair, grayish-white, was combed into a tight bun, not a single strand running loose. Her face, the high cheekbones, the very prominent forehead, and the deep-set eyes reminded me of a photograph of a female Soviet pilot in my textbook. I wondered if Professor Shen had some mixed blood. It was a secret of mine to study people's faces. I must take after my mother, who, apart from studying my face at meals, rarely took a bite. Sometimes, waiting for us to finish eating, she would comment on the people passing by outside the window. "Oily and puffy as fresh fried dough," she described a woman living a floor above us. The man next door had a long and bitter-looking face like a cucumber. My mother was the prettiest woman I had known until then, with almond-shaped eyes and a small, heart-shaped face, a straight and delicate nose, and, as I later learned from the collection of romantic novels from the early 1900s, a cherry petal mouth. When she grew tired of watching the world, she would study her own face in an oval mirror that she kept close to her all day. "A princess trapped in the fate of a handmaiden," she would say to no one in particular. My father, eating silently, would look up at her with an apologetic smile, as if he were a parent responsible for his child's deformed body. My father had married late in his life, my mother early, he at 50 and she at 20. 2 years later, they had me, their only child. When I was in elementary school, other children often mistook him for my grandfather. But perhaps that was because he had to be a parent to my mother, too. Together, my mother and I made my father grow old fast. You could see that in his stooped back and sad smile. "Do you always let your mind wander in front of your teacher?" Professor San asked, though I could see the question was more an amusement than a criticism. And I'm going to skip just a couple pages. So, jump to the next scene. Still in Professor Shan's room. She studied me and then picked up a notebook and turned to a random page. "Read the line to me," she said. The book was the first one in a series called Essential English, which Professor Shan had used to learn English 50 years ago. The page had a small cartoon of a child on a seat, the kind one could find in a luxury theater. In the cartoon, the child, who was not heavy enough to keep the seat from folding back, smiled uncertainly on the high perch, and I felt the same. I had entered middle school earlier that month and had barely learned my alphabet. When I could not read the caption, Professor Shan put the book back with the other volumes, their spine different colors that were equally faded. "You do know that you are not your parents' birth daughter, don't you?" She turned and faced me. "And you do know that no matter how nicely they treat you, they can't do much for your education, don't you?" I had not doubted my blood until then. I knew that my parents were different from most parents, but I had thought it was their age difference and my mother's illness. "Mo Yan," my mother sometimes said my name in a soft voice when my father was not around, and I would know that she had some secrets to tell me. "A man can have children until he's 70, she would say. "A woman's youth ends the moment she marries. Mu Yan, do not let a man touch you, especially here and here," she would say, gesturing vaguely toward her own body. "Mu Yan, your father would get you a stepmother the moment I died," she would say, narrowing her eyes in an amused way. "Do you know that I cannot die because I don't want you to live under a stepmother?" In one of these revelatory moments, she could have said, "Mo Yan, you were not born to us. We only picked you up from a garbage dump." But no, my mother had never, even in her most uncharitable moment, said that to me. And in fact, she kept the secret until her death. And for that alone, I loved her and love her still. "If your parents haven't told you this, someone else must," Professor Shan said when I did not reply. "One needs to know where she came from. Do you understand?" I'm going to stop here. Thank you.